Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Indian paramilitary troops and police encircle Ayodhya today, where a religious site, the most incendiary plot of land in the nation, stands empty. It was in this northern town a decade ago that Hindu hardliners tore down a 16th century Muslim mosque, sparking the worst violence in more than 40 years, leaving over 2,000 dead. Last month, the site was again a spark, igniting mob violence that left 700 dead. This week, more fear from Delhi to Bombay. Hindu worshippers were set to defy a court order and begin building a temple on the site of the old mosque, but troops were deployed, and 18,000 people have been arrested in hopes of preventing yet another bout of communal violence. The lead editorial in today's Times of India puts the responsibility for resolving this ongoing tension squarely on the shoulders of India's ruling party, the BJP government, with its roots in Hindu fundamentalism, but skewing lately towards a secular middle. Connection listeners, what do you think the violence in India says about the future of its government? Do you think it's politics that tears at the seam of this nation, or religion? We ask you to call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me today from a studio in New York City is Ashutosh Barshni. He is a professor of political science and director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan. He's also author of the new book, Ethnic Conflict and Civic Life, Hindus and Muslims in India. We hope later in the program to be talking with Mark Tully, former BBC correspondent there. But Ashutosh, I will begin with you because... you know, this, I have to wonder whether or not you were in any way surprised that the subject of your academic study, specifically the same area of India, suddenly is back in the news again.
No, not very surprised, only a little bit. Partly because the Hindu-Muslim cleavage is really a major fault line of Indian politics. And like race here, Hindu-Muslim problems are not going to go away easily. It'll take a lot of work. Surprise, but not mightily so.
And it appears, the two of us are in the United States looking at what's happening halfway around the world, but it appears that it is the politicians who have been able to broker an end to it, at least for today. Do you see it that way as well?
Yes, the politicians can both worsen the problem as well as provide solutions, or in any case moderate the tensions. And today they played the moderating role. And in Gujarat, 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago, they played an exacerbating role.
So if we go back to the beginning of this latest round of communal violence, were the roots of that political as well? I'm thinking of your own studies that go back and say, you know, when we look at communal violence in the past, quite often it's with a change of government. In fact, the BJP, the ruling party, recently lost power in the state of Uttar Pradesh, where Ayodhya is located. So do we look at political roots to what happened most recently?
Well, quite often, that kind of connection can easily be established. But I'm not sure it's true in this most recent case. The best way to look at a spurt of rioting is to actually concentrate on two things. One, what kind of spark emerged? What was the intensity of the spark? The spark here was the torching of the train in the town of Godhra by a Muslim mob. This spark in 1992, December, was the tearing down of the mosque. The spark could be something as small as the rumor of a rape in a city or rumor of police brutality. Not the fact of it, just the rumor. It could also be a fact, of course. So sometimes sparks are planted, which is when they can be quite political. But sometimes sparks emerge, and then different towns, and that's the second point in my book, different towns respond to that spark very differently. So even in the most recent phase, the three towns of Gujarat, identified by the book as the most sensitive in that state, Ahmedabad, Baroda, and Godhra, were the three worst towns once again. So the question is, what kind of spark? Sometimes it's politically engineered, that spark. And secondly, what kind of local relationships exist between Muslims and Hindus? And rioting, where exactly rioting takes place, is a mixture of the two.
And you look at four pillars. You look at the local business connections, you look at the history of trade unions, you look at local politics and the sort of Gandhian civic organizations, which, evolve over time, may not be as connected to the ideals of Gandhi today, but there are others that have sort of sprung up in more recent years. And when it comes to identifying not so much where the spark comes from, but how then the violence is fanned. What is the role of those particular institutions in either helping calm it down or helping fan the flames?
Yeah, let's just concentrate on the most violent city in Gujarat of late. That's the city of Ahmedabad, where more than 500, it would seem, people were killed. The numbers, I suppose they'll be around 500. From the 1920s through 1950s, the Gandhian civic institutions, on the one hand, lots and lots of social institutions Gandhi made, homespun societies, literary societies, etc., etc., and a cadre-based political party, Congress Party, which Gandhi inspired in the 20s, and a trade union which Gandhi himself actually put in place in 1922 or 23.
That was the textile workers?
That's the textile workers, yes. And the local businesses, of course, had been traditionally integrated there. So all this set of institutions in that city always work to calm tensions down and would neutralize, if you will, the sparks or shut them out from the local scene. But by the 1960s, the Congress Party was in disarray, and the union, the textile union, had broken down. And Gandhian social institutions themselves were in deep disarray. As a result, this town, which was widely viewed, and rightly so, as the most civic and the most integrated town of India, Ahmedabad, Gandhi's adopted hometown, by the late 60s was not ready to deal with the sparks. And when a small spark came in 69, something to do with the cows of Jagannath Temple there and the attack, presumed attack on those cows by a Muslim mob, that led to the most ferocious rioting ever recorded in post-independence India, worse than what happened 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago. Mm-hmm. So here is an example of how the local level institutions are extremely critical to understanding where rioting takes place. State politics or national politics can indeed provide the spark. In this particular case, 2 weeks ago, I'm not sure the spark was clearly connected to the loss of BJP, electoral losses of BJP in several states. Maybe there was a connection, and it has to be established by, through meticulous, one has to establish it through meticulous research. But certainly, the torching of the train was a very big spark, and not as big as the tearing down of the mosque in 92, but a very big spark. And retaliatory killings were expected. What was surprising, in Ahmedabad certainly, where the integrated structures don't exist anymore, what is surprising is the scale of retaliatory brutality, not retaliatory killings themselves. And that's where, once again, the government or politics would be very relevant. It is, I think, almost clearly virtually clearly the case that the government simply looked away as mobs went on a rampage. The government's job was to isolate the criminals who attacked the train and punish them to the legal maximum. Instead of doing that, the government in the state of Gujarat, the state government, which is a BJP government, unlike Delhi, which is BJP in a coalition,
right.
In the state of Gujarat, it's a BJP government through and through. And that government simply looked away, didn't calm public anger, didn't contain public anger, but, you know, in a way became a representative of public anger, and that's not how any government should act.
Ashu, let's look ahead, if we can, because in the late 80s, early 90s, the BJP built its power base in large part behind L.K. Advani, a man who spoke very specifically about the need to rebuild a Hindu temple at the site of Ayodhya. He's seen as the man who, in fact, led the group of people who took the temple down in 1992. And then about the time that I moved to Delhi working as a correspondent in the mid-90s, the BJP was something of a juggernaut, moving its way towards central government power at the same time as the Congress government was falling apart amid all sorts of accusations of corruption and having been in office for far too long. And yet, you know the politics of that country as well as I do. You can't rule without a coalition. When the BJP finally got power, they had to tone down that Hindu fundamentalism because they actually were bringing Muslims in as part of the coalition. Now, they've held that together for the last 4 years, but it looks like it's coming unstuck. Where does it go from here?
Well, yes, I would say that the BJP part of the coalition, or BJP itself, it's the largest part of the coalition, would have to try and figure out how to combine or how to deal with two contradictory impulses. One is simply that if it wants to keep the coalition intact, this 22-23 party coalition intact, it cannot return to the days of the Ayodhya agitation and support Hindu right. Because not only the Muslims in that coalition, very few actually Muslims in that coalition, but the more important element in that coalition would be the lower caste parties. The lower caste parties, which typically have an alliance with Muslims, and they do not have an anti-Muslim stance, or have never had actually historically an anti-Muslim stance in their politics. So the lower caste parties or some regional parties would doubtless leave the coalition if the BJP heads towards the Hindu hardliners, now embraces them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, and this is the contradictory impulse which it has to deal with somehow, if it does not do even something very symbolic or something small for the Hindu hardliners, for Hindu right, then BJP loses some of its most committed cadres. The most committed cadres are the right wingers, are not
and
the
moderates. In political terms, these are the people who actually work for the party. They need them.
Yes, they work for the party. They campaign for the party. When mobilization is launched, they are the people who go out on the street and mobilize. So, will it go towards appeasing the cadres, and to what extent, or will it go towards appeasing the coalition partners, especially the lower caste parties in the coalition? This is what the BJP has to sort out right now. And depending on what it does, the government either will stay or fall. At this point, it seems the BJP has taken a position that it would not appease Hindu hardliners beyond a small extent.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We've been listening to Ashutosh Varshney talk about the current situation with India's young democracy, the strains that communal violence continue to place on the politicians who have such a difficult time holding those coalitions together, who it is they need to appease, and how it is they can hold on to power, and how important it is for India to maintain its status as the world's largest democracy. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
4571.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about the religious and political tensions that are current in India right now, March 15th. This day was a testing day for the government, for the the temple site of Ayodhya because Hindu fundamentalists had promised to ignore the security forces and march on the temple anyway. They did not do that. There was a deal brokered. There are lots of soldiers who have been arresting people. Some figures say up to 18,500 people over the past few days have been arrested to make sure that there is not a return to the sort of communal violence which tore through northern India in the last 10 days, 2 weeks. I have with me on the program Ashutosh Varshney. He's professor of political science and director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan. And we're joined on the line now by Mark Tully, who's former BBC India correspondent, author of No Full Stops in India, numerous books and articles, currently working as a freelance journalist and based in Delhi. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Mark, we were talking just before the break about the fact that there is a deal in place and it appears that that things are quiet in India. The question for you there at this moment is, will it hold?
Well, it's very difficult to tell how long this is going to hold because there are many people within the government, within the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, who will be very unhappy about this compromise. But I think also there is another side to this story, and that is that we have seen a huge amount of public support for this. So really, it's a question in some ways of political management, of whether the government eventually, or the ruling party, the BJP, the top party in the coalition, decides that they have to give something to their more extreme Hindu wing within the party, or whether they want to hold on to power.
Mark, you covered the violence in 1992 when the Babri Masjid was torn down, and the numbers are anywhere from 1,000 people to 3,000 people who were killed in the communal violence which spread across India in the days after that. And you've also worked in Ahmedabad when violence broke out there. And in every case, I'm thinking of a feature article of yours that I was reading last night, you come at it from a point of view of asking the question, is this religious or is this political? What's your thought on what's going on now?
Well, I think it's entirely political. And I think if you look at the recent riots in Gujarat again, you'll see the role that politics played there. You'll see that you have a BJP government in power there. You'll see that everyone says that the government did nothing to stop these riots for at least a day. Then when the government finally decided to put its foot down, basically things calmed down. There's still a bit of tension in some places. It's not totally calm. But once the government decided to act, then the situation was brought under control. And I think all these problems are largely created by politicians, not just incidentally of the BJP, the Gandhi family's Congress Party has practiced what I would call religious politics too. But basically, on the whole, I still believe that Hindus and Muslims, and the vast majority of them, live peacefully side by side in India.
Ashutosh Varshney, just before we went to the break, you made a reference to the fact that within this political system, there is a change that you've noted, and that is a rise in the power of the lower caste parties, and how that may, in fact, do something to soften the sharp edge of religion that the politicians can play against each other. How does that work?
Yes, if you look at 20th century politics in India, and I'd be very interested in how Mark comments on this later on. You actually find an inverse relationship between lower caste politics and communal politics. So parts of India where lower caste politicians rose to power and ran governments, the communal divide either became irrelevant or peripheral. And parts of India where communal politics rose to power and communal politicians did, either in the form of BJP or in the form of Congress Party before the BJP, you had lower caste politics, if you will, struggling for survival. Now, the most remarkable change in the last 20 years is that in two North Indian states, Bihar and UP, two largest states of India, two of the largest states of India, lower caste politicians actually have been becoming stronger and stronger. And in the rather infamous state of Bihar, there has been no communal rioting, Hindu-Muslim rioting, for almost 13 years now. Bihar did not lose a single life to Hindu-Muslim riots, even after the mosque was torn down on December 6, 1992. Now, that's an example of how the rise of lower caste politicians, whatever else they do, what they do for sure is they try and arrest the Hindu-Muslim divide. That has started happening in UP also. So if my argument is right, then in Uttar Pradesh, the largest state of India, and if it were an independent nation, the seventh largest nation of the world, you would see actually declining Hindu-Muslim tensions because lower caste politics are beginning to take greater and greater hold.
Mark, can you speak to that?
Yes, I think that what Ashu has said is basically fundamentally right. You see, what one has to realize is that the communal politicians are really representing the upper castes. So the lower castes on the whole, and particularly, of course, the Dalits, the former untouchables, have no interest in this sort of politics. And it's very interesting that we just had two things I think are very interesting. Ayodhya is in Uttar Pradesh, and therefore you would have thought that after Gujarat went up in flames, Uttar Pradesh would also go up in flames. It did not go up in flames. It's also very significant that we've just had an election in Uttar Pradesh where the BJP tried to revive the temple issue and where many people thought this whole campaign to start the building of the temple in Ayodhya was part of that campaign, and the BJP has fared poorly, much below what they expected in that election. What parties which have done well are parties which represent the lower castes.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Somerville, Massachusetts, and inviting Alexander to join us. Hi, Alexander.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just think it's very important to look at this conflict in a historical context. I mean, you're asking whether it's a religious or a political issue, and it seems fairly inseparable in India. I mean, I guess it's important to look at whether India can make this work as the world's largest democracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it needs to be a secular pluralist state, but obviously the tensions between the Muslims and the Hindus are incredibly you know, long-standing, you know, going back to 15th, 16th century. And I guess the question I have for the speakers there, who are definitely more more wise about these sorts of things than I am at this point, is how can that happen? How can you get a representative democracy? How can you continue to extend the model which India has put forward for being the world's largest democracy? You know, it seems incredibly important for it to succeed in the context of, you know, hoping that the world's other largest country, China, can also modernize and really show representative democracy for its poorest and most needy citizens.
But are you asking, Alexander, whether or not it can happen from within or whether or not there's any kind of sort of outside encouragement that would help?
Well, I suppose I put it in the context of Africa. You know, President Clinton, during his term, went back to Africa and was really quite apologetic for the remnants of colonialism. What responsibility does the British have for the remnants of colonialism that exists in Pakistan and India now? What responsibility does the Western world have for working with India, concerning partition and in Kashmir? Obviously, we're very concerned about the situation between Pakistan and India. What happens if India becomes destabilized? How involved should other countries be in what's happening there?
Mark, I'm not sure whether or not the telephone line allowed you to hear Alexander's question, but in essence, it's the responsibility of the former colonizers of India and Pakistan, and whether or not it isn't in large part a continuation of that history that we're watching play out.
No, I wouldn't say it's responsibility. No, I mean, I wouldn't say it would be helpful for any outside power, particularly in the case of India, to try to get its possibility. I think that would be deeply resented here. And I think, and I'd be very interested to know what Ashu says about this, but we have to remember that India suffered terrible riots and terrible bloodshed after partition. Everything calmed down after that. had these spurts of communal violence since then. I saw it happen in 92. I saw it happen after Indira Gandhi was assassinated in 84. But it does go back to normal again. And I think we mustn't get this situation out of context. We must remember that since Ayodhya and the mosque was pulled down in 92, which many Indians deplore, we have really had comparative communal harmony between Hindus and Muslims. So I certainly think this is a problem we have to leave India to deal with. And I think there is every hope that people will move away from communal politics. And I think what we've seen today is that the temple issue is not nearly as emotive an issue as the extreme Hindu organizations would like it to be and had hoped they had made it.
Ashu, do you share that view?
Yes, I agree with Mark. Let me quickly summarize the findings of my book, which go in the same direction as Mark's argument. First of all, between 1950 and 95, only 4% of deaths in Hindu-Muslim rioting took place in rural India, which is where two-thirds of India still lives. It was primarily an urban problem. And secondly, within urban India, nearly half of all deaths in Hindu-Muslim riots between 1950 and 1995 took place in a mere 8 cities. And in those 8 cities, only 5 to 6% of India lives and about one-fifth of urban India. Therefore, it's fair to, first of all, conclude that it's a highly locally concentrated problem, the problem of rioting. The problem of communalism may be wider, but the problem of communal rioting is highly locally concentrated. And secondly, repeatedly, India has returned from periods of high rioting, as Mark put it, to periods of relative harmony between Hindus and Muslims. There are tensions, there are small skirmishes, but they get managed. There are recuperative mechanisms within Indian society to deal with that. And therefore, the best way to contextualize this problem is to say that India would yet again display its recuperative mechanisms, and one would return from the madness of Gujarat of two weeks back.
1-800-423-8255. That's our number. Alexander, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
We're going to Oxford, North Carolina. Harry's joining us. Hello, Harry.
My basic thing was that it is not a really political problem. I believe that it is on an individual basis that every time there is an Islamic front anywhere or an Islamic group anywhere, there have always been crimes. And as an individual in India who's lived there and gone through the riots, I think that it's more so ever that basically Hindus and Muslims have been able to get along as there is no problems. But as soon as there is a problem of any kind, political, they sort of get the hatred against each other too much.
I guess that's what we're talking about, though, Harry, is whether or not those problems aren't almost always political, that the people will live together if they're not driven into some kind of conflict.
To an extent, yes. But one point that this all does boil down to Kashmir, because basically India used to be even called Hindustan, that is a living place of Hindus. Mm. And it is shared by a whole lot of people, and that is something really nice. But as soon as, like, you talk of Muslims, people start getting worried. It's not only Hindus, but all of the religions in India get worried about the people, because majority of the crime anywhere in the world is done by Muslims.
Harry, let me ask Mark Tully about that, because when we look at the history of this conflict, we're drawn to look back to, you know, the 1992 and the destruction of the mosque, and beyond that to the construction of the mosque. But, Mark, Harry's saying that you can't take Kashmir and the angst over that issue out of this particular discussion. Oh, I think we've lost Mark. Ashu, can you help with that?
I mean, that Kashmir continues to be a burning issue in Indian politics, and has been so, of course, for 12, 13 years now. Mm. It's been an issue for 50 years, but not a burning issue for 12, 13 years. It does provide a certain context within which anxieties go up. But to connect it to Gujarat riots more in a more direct way than that would be, I think, not fair. because you know, we have to establish who exactly were the people, what kind of Muslim mob really torched that train. And then there's also this whole question of why Gujarat government did not restrain Hindu mobs from going on a rampage, from torching Muslim homes, hacking and killing. So there is the best that one can say to the caller is that, yes, the uncertainties of Kashmir do provide an atmosphere of rising anxieties, but it's not clear that those rising anxieties are very directly connected to what happened in Gujarat.
Okay, Harry, thank you for your observation.
Thank you.
We're going to Boston now, and Nasser is joining us. Hi, Nasser.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Thanks for calling.
I appreciate your scholarly analysis. I'm an Indian-born Muslim and actually Pakistani. I migrated to Pakistan as a young kid. What I want to say is that why don't the Muslims realize that the Indian or the Hindu population is trying to erect a monument to their god? What I want to, give an analogy is, what if the Christians or any other, civilization conquered Mecca and took over for, centuries, and later on the Muslims came back and got their Mecca back, and they want to build their Mecca, after conquest. And what would be the condition in that situation?
Are you suggesting
to build their temple? As a Muslim, I think they have the right.
And that as a Muslim from that part of the world, they have that right, and they don't need to be so careful with their politics?
Well, I understand the mixture of politics and religion. From the religious point of view, they should be understanding specifically they are minority in living in the majority. They have to have some kind of consideration.
All right. You know what I'm going to do, Nasser, because we're going to a break here. I'm going to thank you for your call. We will start with Ashu speaking about that when we come back. And I'll just take a moment to remind our listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Things are quiet in India today, thanks in large part to the central government putting some 14,000 police and paramilitary troops in the area of Ayodhya, as well as throughout Maharashtra and various other parts where there were concerns that there could be a resurgence of communal violence. We're talking about that in larger terms now, what its causes are and what the possible solutions could be. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, Ashutosh Varshney, professor of political science, director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan. His brand new book is called Ethnic Conflict and Civic Life, Hindus and Muslims in India. We had with us in the last part of the program Mark Tully, BBC India correspondent. You'll know from the quality of the phone line that we weren't able to keep that connection going, so I'll say thanks to Mark for being with us. And just a reminder to our listeners that if you want to go to our website at theconnection.org, you can see an infographic there which depicts the disputed Indian holy site, Ayodhya, that we're talking about as part of today's conversation, and also a photo gallery covering the recent conflict. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And Ashu, just before we went to the break, our caller was saying, if I can paraphrase him accurately, that in effect, even though he comes at this from the position of a Muslim who was born in India, let the Hindus rebuild the temple if it is such of such significance, religious significance to them. Is it possible?
Well, three responses to that. First of all, why isn't Muslim politics in India more accommodative? Secondly, whether one can force it to be more accommodative. And thirdly, is it the right moment now to be more accommodative? I think these are three analytically connected but also separable issues.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, a number of not most of us, a number of us, a number of us in 89, 90, 91, 92 thought that Muslim politicians actually had a unique opportunity. They could have been accommodative on Ayodhya then, and that would have basically disarmed disarmed Hindu nationalists and made them less powerful in Indian public space.
Can I just call you on that for a minute? Because there are those who are extreme Hindu nationalists who have used the Ayodhya temple as an issue to assert that nationalism, that fundamentalism. And so if the Ram temple were to be rebuilt, could they not simply look for another point?
Yeah. No, I think the deal in 1989-90 could have been on something like this. The Hindu right says that there are 6,000 mosques today in India, over 6,000, built on sites where temples stood previously in medieval times and at various centuries. So a deal could have been struck, brokered, let's say, which could have taken the following form. All right, go build a temple in Ayodhya, but leave the other points untouched.
I see.
Now, this kind of deal, I think, there was a space for that at that point, but I don't think there's a space for that anymore.
That brings you to the third point about whether or not this is the moment to
This is not the moment.
Right? Yeah.
This is not the moment, because now if Muslim politicians concede that point, it'll simply be bowing down to pressure and would actually be quite, politically speaking, a humiliation. Or accepting humiliation. And at that point, I don't think people would have said it was accepting humiliation. Now, there was a second point I raised, which is that can this be forced upon Muslim politicians? Of course not. If they themselves, I'm culturally a Hindu, I'm not a religious Hindu, but I don't think any liberal like me would say that we can force accommodative political stances on Muslim politicians. If they themselves come up with this idea, the idea that your Muslim caller just proposed, then it would be a different matter altogether. But I don't think this can be forced upon them. And in any case, choosing that option now is going to be extremely politically difficult, if not impossible.
Right. Things need to cool a little bit. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And that was Nasser we had on the phone. Thank you, Nasser, to Indira now, who's joining us from Mansfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Indira.
Hello.
Hi. Can you take care of your baby and talk to me at the same time?
Okay. My question is, how far back is one willing to go in history to figure out what should be there at the site? What is legitimate to have at that site? Because 10 years ago, this mosque was raised. And
yes.
But it is claimed that there was a temple before that mosque was built on that site. So I was wondering, what is legitimate at that site, a mosque or a temple?
No, it's a great question.
But both had been there, and if a temple is built now, would one be willing to protect it with as much zeal as they are protecting mosque now?
I know that the Indian central government has had a team of archaeologists working in that area to try and figure out what the origins of the site are, and Ashu, I mean, we really basically know that the Babri Masjid, the mosque, was built in the 16th century, and things get a little bit fuzzy before that. Is that right?
Yeah, it's right. And I think it's for historians and archaeologists to settle that question. It's there is no good answer or no consensus that profession has developed on this. So it will be unfair for me to judge that. It's for them to decide, and I don't think the courts can decide that either.
But although that's what the politicians are hoping will be the case now. They're waiting until they can get a little bit more archaeological information and then let the courts make a ruling. Have I got that right?
The courts can't make, I think, two kinds of rulings. The courts can't decide whether Ram was born there. That's a matter of faith. That they can't decide. They can't decide exactly if historians and archaeologists can't provide evidence whether there was a Ram temple there before and it was torn down and a mosque was raised instead. Mosque was built instead. I think the basic issue for courts is who owns that property? And secondly, whoever owns that property, is private ownership of that property now, does private ownership of that property now have grave political, grave public consequences?
Right.
So on those two issues, I think the court has to pronounce its judgment. And what exactly stood there before 1526, 1527 is really for a very different profession to settle and clarify.
Indira, thanks for your call. We're going to Malden, Massachusetts now, and John is joining us. Hi, John.
Hi, Dick.
Thanks for calling.
Not at all. I'm from Kerala, and as those of you know about Indian history and Indian geography know that Kerala has one of the highest literacy rates. And my point is that more than anything else, injustice, oppression, and social injustice creates the masses where, fuel for the fodder, well, for this fire. And there has not been any communal riots in Kerala to speak of, except in the early 1900s, there was something called the Mapala Lehala, and this happened in an area of Kerala which was the least educated.
But John, I can tell you from looking at Ashutosh's book that he notes an increase in literacy from 4-5% up to 45-55% in places where there is still communal violence.
Well, there is oppression. You know, it takes a long time for things to seep down.
So it's more that you're saying get the education
in. I feel, you know, of all the places in India, there's the least oppression or, you know, most social justice. There is no abject poverty in Kerala. And Gujarat is one of the, you know, industrial states of India, most industrialized in some ways, as you know, the textile factories and everything. But there is abject poverty. There's a tremendous social injustice in those areas.
One of the things that Ashutosh writes about in his book is the Self-Employed Women's Association, SEWAS, as perhaps a grassroots way out of this kind of reactionary politics. Is that right, Ashu?
Yeah, generally right. Could I comment on
yeah,
the
please.
Kerala part of the... I think the caller is right, and as is well known, that Kerala has the highest literacy in India, literacy rate in India, actually almost as high as the United States now, if not higher. And that is a remarkable achievement, given the per capita level of income that Kerala has. And it's also true that it has had tremendous success with its social justice programs. But I think trying to connect that to communal violence or Hindu or Hindu-Muslim rioting would be not analytically fair for the following reason that, first of all, not only is Kerala among the least riot-prone, but also Rajasthan, which is among the least literate. So Kerala might be the most literate, but Rajasthan is among the least literate. It's also not riot-prone. The state of Orissa is also among the least literate, is not riot-prone. So both on the high, the highest literacy end and the lowest literacy end, you have communal peace. Therefore, the argument about literacy and its relationship with communal violence simply doesn't stand up. The point about social justice, the second point that the caller raises, is a bit more complicated, or oppression. I think Muslim minority in India, a lot of them feel that they are an oppressed minority. They are in a state of siege. Some don't. After all, the richest Muslim of India, richest Indian today is a Muslim, Aziz Premji, the software, one of the big software stars of the last 10 years. So they may feel that they're an oppressed minority, but it's also true that there is a certain wing of a certain section of Hindus who also feel equally oppressed, even though they are part of a majority community. Here is a majority community where some people have a grave minority complex. So the question of social justice or oppression, I don't think it's a question which is about objective realities per se. It's also a question about what people perceive to be just or perceive to be the situation of oppression. And that's why drawing clear inferences or clear linkages with Kerala would not be very sensible, I think.
Okay. John, thank you for your call.
Well, may I comment?
Briefly?
Yeah. You know, it's a complex problem. And I'm talking about, you know, attitudes created by social justice and literacy and education. I know Nasser, who called before, and he's a very good friend of mine. I'm a Christian, he's a Muslim, and I have so many Hindu friends, but it's a complex problem. It's a, you know, coincidences of many things. And the proportion of Hindus, Christians, and Muslims in India, in any state, as you may know, Kerala has the highest proportion of Christians, about 20%, and about 25% Muslim, and the rest Hindu.
John, I want to take the observations that you've made and the I think the very clear point that comes through that there is this, you know, wonderful sense of comradeship between Christians and Muslims and Hindus in India. I certainly saw it during all the time that I was living there. And Ashu, maybe put this to you by way of a quote from Salman Rushdie. I'm not sure if you saw the piece that he wrote earlier in The Guardian, but Rushdie, who never really shies away from taking a particularly forceful stand, writes, "The political discourse matters and explains a good deal, but there is something beneath it, something we don't want to look in the face, namely that in India, as elsewhere in our darkening world, religion is the poison in the blood. Where religion intervenes, mere innocence is no excuse. Yet we go on skating around this issue, speaking of religion in the fashionable language of respect." What do you think about the way that he's casting that, Ashu?
I would disagree. I think religion is both a remarkably positive force, and some of the greatest experiments at integration at local levels have been undertaken by religious leaders, and religion has also been a remarkably negative force, putting people against one another, and privileging violence for religious causes. So I think Mr. Rushdie has a very one-sided view of religion. After all, Mahatma Gandhi, one of the greatest religious leaders India saw in the 20th century, one of the greatest leaders arguably the world saw, was a deeply religious man, and he was not a divisive figure at all. And his biggest opponent, Mr. Jinnah, who led the movement for Pakistan, was not religious at all, but was a very divisive figure. So a straightforward relationship between religiosity per se and the poison that he talks about, I don't think it can be drawn. It's both a positive and a negative force, really.
Though in political terms, we continue to watch with fascination India's wrestling with a secular future. Ashu, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show. Really enjoyed it.
Great. Ashutosh Varshney is director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan, author of Ethnic Conflict and Civic Light, Hindus and Muslims in India. We talked earlier with Mark Tully, former BBC India correspondent. If you're in the Boston area, incidentally, Ashu Varshney will be speaking at a conference on ethnic violence this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at Harvard University's Sever Hall. We had help with our program today from Kim Vachari, Dara Manoogi, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine